the boys reach a cluster of berries above their heads, and he carried some back for me. They burst in my mouth with a tangy sweetness.
Sorry,
Alex said. I shook my head. At least now I knew what had happened. And I was practiced at keeping bad memories locked away. There was a Latin inscription next to the tower door, surrounded by a design of waves and sea serpents. I peered at it. Affronte precipitium atergo lupi, I read haltingly. What does it mean? He perched next to me.
A precipice in front, wolves behind, he said. It's like being caught between a rock and a hard place, or between the devil and the deep blue sea. No way out.
A strong gust of wind produced a tattered plastic bag out of nowhere and sent it flapping across the stone circle. Under my coat sleeves, tiny hairs rose along my arms. Why? Was someone trapped here? Alex tipped his head back and rolled it left and right, stretching.
Dominic reckons the summerborn who built the house was involved in some dodgy money-making schemes. He made his fortune and then lost it all again, promised some of the families in the village he'd help them get rich, but then made enemies of them when he couldn't pay his bills. The villagers used to say Summerborn was, I don't know, not haunted, but unlucky in some way. Have you been into the village much?
I shook my head.
You should ask them, he said. Ask anyone in the village about Summerborn. Their eyes light up, honestly. They were brought up on stories about this place. Not just the murky history of it, but fairy stories too. What do they call them here? Sprites, is it?
Yeah. I'd heard Michael blame sprites when his seeds got mixed up in the greenhouse. Edwin was fascinated with the idea of seeing one, catching one. I pictured them rather like the gremlins from the movie I'd loved when I was 11 or 12. But fairy stories, a bit weird for adults to talk about, isn't it?
God knows what really happened here.
Alex grinned at me.
They never actually tell you that, of course. They probably don't remember themselves anymore. My neighbour at the cottage told me to watch myself coming up here. I said, I'm only going for a picnic. He virtually crossed himself.
I hugged my arms around my chest. They're probably just jealous. In the village, the people who lived here would always have seemed...
more privileged, Alex said. You're probably right.
I frowned at the inscription. Still, a strange saying for that summerborn ancestor to pick. It sounds like he regretted his behaviour if it made him feel that trapped.
I quite like it,
Alex said, leaning toward me a little as he dropped his voice.
It always strikes me as quite apt for the family. Don't you think they're a bit like wolves, our friends in the house there?
I glanced toward Edwin, but the boys were oblivious to our conversation, feasting on blackberries and giggling, their chins dripping purple. What do you mean? I liked the way his mouth curved upward on one side in a half smile. He leaned closer.
You know, Dominic thinks he's the alpha male, out hunting in the city all week, returning triumphant on a Friday night to feed his pack. But everyone knows Vera's the real alpha, with all the real money and power. She's the one who oversees the pack, brings new blood in to make it stronger. I bet she turned up at your interview, didn't she? To inspect you before Ruth gave you the job.
I licked my lips. After Ruth offered me the job, actually. But yes.
There you go. She's got half the village eating out of her hands, that woman. She's always rescuing people, helping people out. And then she calls in the favour when she needs it. Or when the family needs it.
What are you then? I asked. New blood? When he laughed, his elbow bumped against mine.
Hardly. I'm not obedient enough for that anyway. No, I'm just a lone wolf roaming through their territory, We circle around each other every so often, and then I go off and look for a more suitable pack.
But you haven't found one?
Not yet.
His mouth half curved again. I turned to watch the boys for a minute, aware that our sleeves were still touching. So, what am I? I asked.
Ah, you. You're an Omega, a lowly caregiver.
He squinted sideways at me.
You're not a threat to them, so they treat you well.
I frowned. What do you mean?
The pack always comes first, he said. It's more important even than the individuals in it. If you threaten the pack, you know what they'll do to you.
I watched his mouth as he spoke, the flash of his teeth. He leaned toward me again, his gaze on my lips, his voice a whisper.
You wouldn't stand a chance.
Edwin skidded to a halt directly in front of us. Can we go to the beach now? Alex eased away from me. My heart was jumping.
Are you sure you've had enough?
Alex asked Edwin. Dark purple juice stained all around both boys' mouths and ran in streaks down the fronts of their coats.
My tummy's full, Edwin said,
and behind him Joel clutched his abdomen dramatically and nodded.
Well then.
Alex launched into a passable Robin Williams imitation.
Carpe diem. Seize the day, boys.
Let's get down to the beach.
Edwin and Joel whooped, and we abandoned the folly and scrambled down the steps to the sand. The boys raced around in the wind, shrieking, stretching their arms out like airplane wings. I had brought nothing with me, and I suffered a twinge of self-recrimination, knowing that Ruth would have thought to bring a picnic blanket, a flask of tea. But seeing the boys run made me want to join in, so I knocked Alex's arm with the back of my hand and shouted, "Race you to the rocks!" and set off at a sprint.
Hey!
I heard him shout behind me, and his shoes pounded the wet sand as he tried to close the gap, but I beat him.
God, I've got to get fit before I turn 30,
he panted, hunching over with his hands on his knees for a minute. Then,
it!
And he whacked me on the arm and haired back toward the steps. Edwin and Joel joined in, and we played tag on the beach until we were all exhausted, and the boys began to clamour for their lunch.
You can't be hungry again already,
Alex asked them, laughing. I gave the boys the usual instructions to climb the steps carefully, one behind the other, holding on to the railing. As I was about to start after them, Alex caught hold of my wrist. He reached down and picked a spray of tiny purple flowers from the clump of sea lavender at the base of the steps, and he tucked it behind my ear.
Perfect,
he said. I swayed toward him, convinced he was about to kiss me, my heart jumping at the nearness of him, my scalp tingling from his fingers settling the flower stalk in my hair. His lips parted.
Laura!
Edwin called from above. We swayed apart. I dragged my gaze to where the boys waited, 10 steps up the cliff.
You're supposed to be right behind!
Edwin's purple-stained lower lip jutted out, a mix of crossness and anxiety in his expression. Alex gestured to me to start climbing.
We're right here, he told Edwin. Good job, boys. Keep going now, nice and steady.
He continued to chat to the boys on the way back to the house, and I kept my gaze on the ground, wishing I understood whether it meant something or nothing. The flower, the leaning toward, the pulling away. My mood sank further as we reached the lawn and saw the kitchen doors were open. Ruth appeared in the doorway and watched us approach.
Mummy!
Edwin yelled, running toward her. Alex kept his chin high, his focus directly on Ruth. No sideways glance at me. I tugged the flowers from my hair and slowed my stride. Ruth kissed the top of Edwin's head. Go and wash your hands and face, darling, and take Joel with you. You can play inside then until your lunch is ready. When she straightened, her gaze was fixed on Alex.
Ruth, you look wonderful.
Alex opened his arms as he walked up to her. She allowed him to kiss her on each cheek.
her expression taut. I hesitated on the patio, turning to look out at the garden.
Are we still on for our lunch date?
He asked her, and I could tell he wasn't confident of her answer.
Why not? She replied, after a heartbeat's pause, and then, Laura, please make sure Edwin eats a sandwich before any more fruit, won't you?
By the time I had turned to acknowledge this, they were walking away side by side, and I heard Alex's car engine start up a minute later. There was a bird-pecked apple on the patio table, and I picked it up and examined it. I thought of Ruth saying, at his beck and call, and I pressed my thumbnail through the wrinkled green skin into the spongy flesh. Alex didn't deserve someone who made him wait, who made him feel guilty when he hadn't done anything wrong. He deserved someone who would race with him on the beach in the wild wind and laugh at the sky. He deserved someone who loved him, someone who was free to love him. In the kitchen, I prepared ham sandwiches for myself and the boys. I sliced two unblemished apples into perfect crescents and arranged them on a plate alongside a mountain of chocolate fingers. Afterward, while Edwin and Joel were pushing trains around a wooden track in the day nursery, I escaped to the annex and slid the wilting purple flowers that Alex had given me between pages of my heaviest textbook and pressed them flat.
11. Seraphine. I love waking up at Winterbourne. I love lying with my eyes closed and listening to the soft rumble of traffic outside. The snatches of phrases from cyclists whizzing by. The leisurely comments drifting up from neighbours as they emerge from their houses. This morning, there is high-pitched yapping from a little dog. And then the clatter of the trash truck as it begins its stop-start progress down the street. I trace the familiar embroidery pattern on the bedspread with my fingertips like I used to on childhood visits to Granny Vera. Even the scent of the wood polish on the mahogany bedside table takes me back to being 7 years old again. And for a moment, I pretend that all is well, and my dad is still here, pottering around in the kitchen downstairs, brewing his coffee and reading his newspaper. By the time I descend to the kitchen, Edwin has left for work. Danny is frying bacon, yawning. How many are coming? I ask, eyeing the panful. Funny. I need energy. Brooke's taking me on a walking tour of the city with some friends of her parents. I raise my eyebrows. Friends of her parents? How serious is this? He ducks his head. I'm not used to seeing Danny embarrassed, and it gives me a little jolt of amusement, alongside some other more protective emotion. He shrugs.
I like her, that's all, he says. Listen, sis, I was thinking about last night, that letter, and Dad's accident.
He looks at me, hesitating.
Dad said something a few days before he died. When I first got back, he said he had something he wanted to tell us when we were all together.
What do you mean? I ask, pouring milk onto my muesli.
I don't know. He said he was glad we were all going to be together that weekend, our birthday weekend. There was something he wanted to tell us.
I pause with my spoon halfway to my mouth.
Well, what was it?
I ask. Then see his expression and add,
Okay, you don't know.
I put my spoon down slowly. Dad's accident happened on a Thursday, the day before Danny and I turned 25. He'd driven over to Summerbourne to start preparations for the family party we had planned for the Saturday. We think he might have been trying to rescue one of the farm kittens from the garage roof. He fell off the ladder onto the driveway and hit his head and died. Edwin and I were at work that day, Edwin in London and me in Norwich. But Danny was freshly returned from working abroad and was catching up with friends in the village, so he was the first of us to arrive at Summerbourne and find him. It was Danny who had to watch the paramedics shake their heads. It was Danny who had to talk to the police, phone the rest of us, ward off the curious neighbours, pick me up off the gravel when I got home. "Did Dad say anything to Edwin about this?" I ask eventually, but Danny shrugs.
"I'd forgotten about it until this morning. Do you think it means anything? No one was there when he fell."
He looks down then, blinking at the bacon he's laid out on his bread.
"That's what I keep thinking. No one was there. How can we be sure it was an accident?" "Danny!"
I push my chair back and get up, walk to the sink, turn around and walk back. "The police said it was an accident."
"I know."
I can tell that, like me, he's remembering our conversation last night. The implication in the letter that Dad's death was far from an accident, and my insistence that this was a hollow threat. I attempt to summon back that certainty now, but there's a tremor in my voice. "You can't think someone killed him?
Murdered him?
Because of this thing he was going to tell us?" I concentrate on breathing, trying to push the distressing image from my mind. "Please, Danny. It's not true. It can't be true." We hold each other's gaze, and I feel as though I'm waiting for him to leap up and grab me by the shoulders and tell me it is true, it's horribly true. But as he's just pointed out, no one was there. How can we be sure either way? Danny breaks eye contact first.
"I'm sure you're right, sis," he sighs. "This is probably a normal reaction, looking for someone to blame or whatever. I shouldn't have said anything."
He takes a bite of his bacon sandwich. I tip my muesli into the sink, flushing it down the waste disposal. Through the window, I glimpse a slim figure with white blonde hair gliding past the railings and pushing open the Winterbourne gate. I turn back to Danny.
"But you think he might have been going to tell us something about all of this?"
I say, waving my hand toward the dining room.
"This weirdness? Laura?"
The doorbell rings. My twin brother sits and looks at me for another moment and then gets to his feet, still holding his sandwich.
"I don't know what to think anymore,"
he says, and pads out to the hall with me close behind. He turns to me as I start to climb the stairs.
"What are your plans for the day?"
he asks.
"Are you going back to Summerbourne?"
"Yep." He gives me a long look.
"Don't do anything stupid, will you?"
he says. The doorbell rings again.
"What, like going on a walking tour of the city on the hottest day of the year?"
He pulls a face at me, and I dash up out of sight before he swings the front door open. From the privacy of my bedroom, I ring Alex Kaimal's work number, and a friendly-sounding man assures me that he's in the office all day. The address is on an industrial estate in a suburb south of Leeds. I hope Alex is going to prove easier to talk to than Laura. I shower and dress and wait upstairs until I hear Danny and Brooke leave, and then I set off. Roadwork stretches the journey to over 4 hours, and when I eventually switch my engine off in front of Alex's steel-framed block of a workplace, I realise my stomach is growling. I can't afford to mess this up. I need to get on with it. I brush my hair, apply lipstick, and attempt to smooth the creases from my dress before I leave the car. At one end of the low-ceilinged reception area is a horseshoe arrangement of chunky padded chairs in sherbet colours and a water dispenser. At the other end, a woman and a man murmur into phones behind the reception desk. I catch the man's eye as he hangs up.
"I'd like to see Alex Kaimal, please," I say. "Quite urgently. Could you ask him to come down and meet me?"
The man smiles.
"Sure. Is he expecting you?"
"No, I did mean to email him, but..." What can I say? I was afraid if Alex saw my name on the email, he'd refuse to see me.
After the reception Laura gave me, I'm not confident that Alex is going to welcome me wholeheartedly. The receptionist is unruffled.
Who shall I tell him?
I swallow. Seraphine. He holds his smile as I press my lips down on my surname at the last moment. Harris, I say. I grip the counter. After a murmured conversation into his phone, he cups his hand over the mouthpiece and tilts his head at me.
I'm sorry. Mr. Kaimal's in a board meeting. His secretary says you can make an appointment for next week if you like.
I fight the urge to snatch the phone from his hand and force myself to smile, as if it doesn't matter in the least. It's fine, I manage, and I turn away as he replaces the handset. I feel lightheaded and walk over to the water dispenser, glancing at the elevator as I pass. Could I march confidently into it without being challenged? The receptionist is busy again, paying me no further attention. I think I could. Could I open every door on each floor and peer inside without someone stopping me? I grip my teeth. Probably not. I press a jet of chilled water into a plastic cup and choose a seat with a view of the elevator doors. I'll wait. I know what Alex Kaimal looks like, and I'll catch him as he leaves the building. I browse through several magazines over the next hour, and nobody says a word to me. Around 4:30, a young woman with a pink streak in her dyed black hair walks in and smiles at me, but she takes a seat at the far end of the horseshoe and concentrates on her phone. I count 34 people out of the elevator before it opens to reveal the man I'm waiting for. He's slightly heavier in the face, clearly older than in the company photo, but this is definitely Alex Kaimal. I get to my feet, but the woman with the pink and black hair is closer to him, and she rises between us and says, "Hi, Dad."
"Kiara,"
he says, smiling. They embrace briefly. They're oblivious to me. I follow them outside.
"Mr. Kaimal,"
I say, but it comes out as a croak, and he doesn't hear me.
"Mr. Kaimal,"
I call louder. The daughter turns first. When Alex Kaimal finally swings round to look at me, we stand facing each other wordlessly. Cold needles prickle down my neck and arms. His frown deepens as he stares at me. The girl looks curiously from one of us to the other.
"Can we help you?"
she asks me. I can't tear my gaze from his face. "I'm Seraphine Mays," I manage to say. "I'm Dominic and Ruth Mays's daughter. I think you were a friend of my parents." His demeanor changes then. His eyes widen. He draws in 2 deep, quick breaths, and he takes a step backward, holding his hands up as if to defend himself.
"Dad?"
his daughter asks, but he doesn't take his eyes off me.
"You can't be," he says eventually. "You can't be. Ruth died."
I step forward warily. "I know. She died on the day I was born," I say. He starts to shake his head, slowly at first and then more violently.
"No. No. It's impossible,"
he says.
"Dad?"
his daughter says again, and he reaches for her hand without breaking eye contact with me.
"We need to go,"
he says, taking another step backward.
"My brother Edwin remembers you,"
I say. An expression of pain distorts his face.
"Why do you say it's impossible?"
I ask. He shakes his head, his mouth slightly open, no sound emerging.
"Have you been in contact with Laura?"
I ask.
"Did you send her a letter?"
"Laura,"
he blurts.
"No. What?"
Then he regains some composure and takes a step toward me and then another, his eyes stretched wide, his face thrust forward.
"Who are you?"
he demands,
and I'm convinced that at any moment he's going to snarl at me. I stumble backward. The young woman tugs at his hand, pulling him away. Dad, stop it! We need to go! Please, let's just go, she says. He relaxes slightly and examines me all the way down to my feet and back up again in a swift moment.
I don't know who you are, he says,
his voice gravelly,
and I don't want to talk to you. Stay away from me. Stay away from both of us.
They cling on to each other as they hurry away from me, crossing the car park and climbing into a car. Several men and women have stopped outside the building and are eyeing me curiously. I'm shaking. Impossible, he said. It's impossible that I'm my parents' child. The conviction that this man is right claws at me, firing off the same three words over and over again in a staccato rhythm at the back of my brain. Who am I?
12. Laura, October to November 1991. When Alex dropped Ruth home after their lunch date, she went directly to her bedroom, claiming a headache. I'd been making flapjacks with Edwin and Joel, and I chewed on a crispy corner piece as I watched the yellow car glide away down the lane. I guessed from Ruth's headache that her outing with Alex hadn't been a success. That night, Dominic arrived at Summerbourne in a jolly mood, but the following morning he came off the phone and into the kitchen with his mouth in a flat line.
That was Alex. He can't come for lunch after all. He's got to go back up to Leeds right away. Some crisis at work.
Ruth shrugged. Oh well, all he could talk about yesterday was the work he's having done on the cottage. It got boring. I wish he'd just ring you when he's in that sort of mood. He's your friend.
Dominic frowned. Come on, you've known him as long as I have. Have you upset him again? I got the feeling this work crisis thing was an excuse.
Well, if informing him that I'm not his employee, I'm not at his beck and call to sort out his interior decorating problems, counts as upsetting him, then yes, maybe. It's his own fault. My jaw tightened. I was in the kitchen to fetch a cup of water for Edwin, and I kept my eyes down and padded back out toward the day nursery. But I hovered out of sight in the utility area between the two rooms.
For God's sake, Ruth, he doesn't need your help. He's just excited. He just wants to include us in his project.
There was a sharp edge of exasperation in Dominic's voice.
Why do you always do this?
You have no idea what it's like for me, stuck out here in the week. Do you think it's all fun and games? I gave up my career for this.
I held my breath. Ruth had told me about the banking career she left when she had the twins, about how much she loved it, how much she missed it. I gripped the door handle of the day nursery, upset at how dismissive she was about the days she shared with Edwin and me.
So let's move into Winterbourne then, Dominic said. Get Edwin into the school the Mellard kids go to. You could pick up some part-time hours, see how it suits.
There was a scrape of chair leg on tiles. I'm not taking Edwin away from Summerbourne, Ruth said. Never. I slipped into the day nursery and kept Edwin out of their way for the rest of the morning. Ruth remained preoccupied even after Dominic returned to London that Monday. Edwin and I fell into a routine of playing outside every morning, in the garden or at the beach, or at the playground in the village, if we fancied a walk and a trip to the shop. We'd return to the house for lunch, and then choose a project for the afternoon, creating models from cardboard boxes, baking biscuits, designing treasure hunts. There was no part of me that minded working longer hours than I was supposed to. The busier I was, the less chance I had to feel lonely, or to dwell on what had and hadn't happened with Alex at the base of the cliff steps. Ruth often drifted into the kitchen as Edwin and I were eating lunch, and she seemed to enjoy Edwin's happy chatter as he told her what we'd been up to. But for 3 weekends in a row, she complained of a headache when Dominic was home. I didn't hear either of them mention Alex's name. Vera phoned on a Tuesday, toward the end of the month.
Would you mind awfully taking Edwin to his gym class tomorrow afternoon, Laura? I'd like to come down and take Ruth out for lunch. Have a proper chat with her. Of course, I replied. No problem. Thank you, my dear. I don't know what we'd do without you. Edwin wasn't fazed by having to walk to his gym class. Helen Luckhurst was there with her solemn son, Ralph. Her new baby daughter, Daisy, muffled in a sling against her chest. She bought me a polystyrene cup of grey coffee and quizzed me about daily life at Summerbourne while we watched the children wobble along beams. Does she act like a proper mum, though, Ruth, when she's at home? She widened her eyes at me, waiting for my reply. Her lips parted. What do you mean? I asked. I mean, she always seems so cold, especially since she lost her other little boy. Does she blame Edwin for that? For distracting her? Does she still love him, do you think? I mean, really, deep down, like a proper mum. I inhaled sharply through my nose and turned away. When she realised I wasn't intending to answer, she shrugged and wandered off to chat to someone else. Ruth and Vera were still out at lunch when Edwin and I got home. I settled him in front of his favourite cartoon video in the day nursery and was in the kitchen when the phone rang. Hello, Summerbourne.
Hi, Laura. It's Alex.
Oh, hi. I stretched the spiral cord between my fingers. It was 3 weeks and 5 days since he'd tucked the flowers into my hair, leaning in so close to me, smiling his half-smile at me. Had he been counting the days too?
I just wondered, is Ruth there?
He said. The telephone cord sprang back at me, bouncing briefly up and down with a rhythm like a laugh. No, sorry, I said. She's out.
Ah, would you mind giving her a message?
I picked up the pencil kept on the hall table for that purpose. Of course.
Could you tell her I'm at the cottage, now until Sunday? If she wants to pop round before the weekend, she'd be very welcome. My neighbours tell me there's a Halloween party on in the village tomorrow night. Do you know if she's thinking of going? Or perhaps I should wait until the weekend.
He paused.
Perhaps I should give Dominic a ring.
Okay, I said. I'll tell her.
Great, thanks, Laura. And thanks for the trip to the beach the other day. It was fun.
I scored a deep grey groove into the pad of post-it notes. Yep, okay, bye. I hung up. Alex at cottage, I wrote on the pad. Party tomorrow night? Ruth stalked into the day nursery to find us when she and Vera got back. How was Jim, darling? She asked Edwin, bending to kiss him. Good, Mummy. She had bright red patches high up on her cheeks, and she narrowed her eyes at me over Edwin's head. Get rid of her, please, she hissed. Who? I asked. My mother. Persuade her to go home. She's going on and on about us making a fresh start, moving into Winterbourne. I can't bear to sit next to her at dinner. Please, Laura. She gave Edwin another kiss and marched out of the room. I trailed after her. Ruth headed directly upstairs. Vera was leaning by the back doors in the kitchen, gazing out at the garden. Is everything all right, Mrs. Blackwood? I asked. She straightened and smiled at me. Absolutely. Quite all right, thank you. I don't think I will stay for dinner after all, though, my dear. Would you mind phoning for a taxi for me? I went out to the hall. The block of post-it notes displayed a fresh blank sheet. The following morning, Edwin and I had clumped into the hall from the garden, shedding wellies and coats and bundles of autumn leaves, before we realised we were interrupting Ruth on the phone. She held her hand over the mouthpiece and waited for us to take our finds through to the day nursery before she resumed talking. A while later, she wandered through to admire Edwin's collage. Laura, I know I said I'd take him to the Halloween thing in the hall this afternoon, but I don't suppose you'd take him for me, would you? Edwin looked from her to me, his glue stick poised in midair. Yeah, of course, I said. Oh, thank you. You're a lifesaver. I want to nip into town and buy a costume for the village do tonight. Lots of the neighbours are going, apparently. Edwin said, Can I come?
Tonight? Ruth ruffled his hair. No, darling, sorry. It's for grown-ups only.
Laura will look after you here. Maybe you could do apple bobbing or something?
Her vague tone sharpened as she met my eyes.
That is, if you don't mind babysitting.
I shook my head.
That's fine.
Edwin put his pirate costume on after lunch, and I drew him a curly moustache and dots of stubble with a black eyeliner pencil. I dropped a flashlight into my bag before we set off. It was the half-term holiday, and the village hall was overrun with children in fancy dress, from pillowcase ghosts to red-horned devils and everything in between. Helen Luckhurst introduced me to Kemi Harris, Joel's mum, recently returned from Nigeria. Kemi thanked me for the biscuits I'd helped Joel bake to welcome her home, but Edwin was tugging at my arm, so I left her chatting to Helen and accompanied him on a tour of the hall. He gripped my hand hard as he queued for games, his eyes wide as he watched the shrieking gangs of children rocketing around the echoing space. He had a turn at biting donuts hanging from strings, and then a go at sliding his hand into the Lucky Dip barrel where slimy toy bugs hid among the sawdust. Two little wizards who pounced on him turned out to be Joel Harris and Ralph Luckhurst, but Edwin hid his face in my cardigan and didn't want to join in their play. I wrapped his scarf around his neck and pulled his hat tightly over his ears before we set off for home, but the sharp air crept underneath our layers and pinched at our skin. I stopped to wipe his nose as we passed the last house before our lane, and a car slowed to a halt. It was Ruth.
Good timing, she said as we clambered in.
I fumbled to do Edwin's buckle up with my numb fingers.
How was the party, darling?
Edwin jutted his lower lip out.
I found the most marvellous witch costume, she said, and Alex has some floor-length black cloaks for us. It will go perfectly.
Later, when I had made cheese on toast for Edwin and bathed him and was reading him stories in bed, Ruth danced into his bedroom. She wore a pointed black hat and a maroon and black velvet dress, and when she spun around, the skirt whirled up into ripples. Her nails and lipstick were blood red, her eyeshadow was dark, and her eyes shone.
Don't like it!
Edwin buried his face into my shoulder. Ruth stopped dancing.
It's only mummy, Edwin, I said. It's just a costume. Isn't it a pretty skirt?
Edwin shook his head without looking. Ruth put her hands on her hips.
Well, Alex is picking me up in a minute. Don't wait up for me, Laura. Just keep the annex door propped open. I'll see you in the morning. Have a nice time, I said.
She swished out of the room, and Edwin rubbed his fists into his eyes.
I don't like mummy like that, he said.
Me neither, I whispered, but she'll be back to normal tomorrow. Don't worry.
I read him more stories and sat with him afterward, stroking his hair until he fell asleep. Then I cleared up the kitchen, covering the top of the half-empty red wine bottle with a square of foil. I dragged my pillow and duvet onto a sofa in the day nursery to be closer to Edwin if he needed me, but my sleep was undisturbed. A grey mist swirled outside the curtainless windows when I woke, the sun barely breaking the horizon. In the hall, Ruth's black boots lay on their side, shining wet. Beads of water glistened on the tiles in a pattern that suggested a larger pair of boots had recently stood next to them. I planned to make a cup of tea and retreat to the annex, but something caught my eye through the hall window on my way back to the kitchen. I took a couple of steps closer and peered out through the gloom. Something swayed under the trees at the entrance to the drive. Was that people out there? I stepped closer to the glass, blinking. Two figures hovered at the corner of the lawn. All traces of sleep left me. I backed toward the phone, my heart thumping.
Should I call the police? Should I wake Ruth? My feet grew chilled on the tiles while I hesitated. Perhaps I should go back to bed, wait for the sun to come up properly. Probably they were innocent neighbours and had already wandered away down the lane. A faint squeal cut through my indecision then, a high-pitched squeak that repeated itself twice more. It sounded familiar. I crept back to the window. Michael stood facing the figures, and he slowly lowered his wheelbarrow. There was something wrong with the swaying shapes, I realised. They weren't people standing on the ground. I grabbed wellies from the cupboard, hauled my coat into my arms. My hands shook as some instinct made me press the door handle down before looking for the keys. The door swung open. My stomach lurched. I stepped outside. Michael watched me approach, his expression grim. The rising sun was beating back the mist, and it was clear now that the two figures were shapes hanging from the branch of one of the ash trees. I stepped closer. "They're not real," I whispered. Michael made no response, but stood with his gaze fixed on me, as if waiting for me to do something. I stretched out trembling fingers and felt velvet. Wet, black velvet. The cloaks that Alex and Ruth had worn to the party, hung up by their hoods. I made a noise like a laugh, from relief rather than humour, but when I turned to Michael, his face was more severe than ever.
"That ain't right," he said.
He shook his head, no longer looking at me. I stumbled away then, back to the house, locking the front door behind me. I dragged my bedding back through to the annex and lay under my duvet until I heard Edwin's cartoons blare out in the day nursery an hour later. When I looked out to the driveway in the grey daylight, the cloaks were gone. Edwin and I stayed indoors all morning. The yellow sports car announced itself with a scatter of gravel while we were making sandwiches for lunch. I pushed the sitting room door open and peered into the shadows. "Alex is here," I said. Ruth sprang up, her hands on her cheeks. The doorbell rang. She whisked the curtains open and ran her fingers through her hair. "I told him not to come back," she said. She straightened her shoulders. "It's fine. Let him in." He stood empty-handed on the doorstep, his gaze flicking past mine to search the hall behind me, his dark hair slick in the drizzle. I stepped back to allow him in and nodded at the sitting room door. Edwin and I ate our sandwiches in the day nursery and watched cartoons all afternoon, not venturing into the main house again until the car had gone. Dominic arrived late that evening with bags of groceries in his trunk. He was dicing onion and crushing garlic the next morning when he asked,
"So what time's Alex coming?"
Ruth leaned against the sink with her back to us. I peeled Edwin's banana for him and gestured for him to follow me out. "I'm not sure he is coming," she said. Dominic paused with his knife poised.
"Why not?"
Ruth shrugged. A minute later, Dominic strode into the day nursery, where Edwin was laying out fresh sheets of paper for painting.
"Hey, Edwin, fancy a trip into the village to see Uncle Alex?"
Edwin scrambled off his chair.
"Yes, yes!"
Dominic gave me a flat smile.
"It's the weekend. You shouldn't be working. I'm afraid we take advantage of you far too much."
"I don't mind," I said.
"Do you want to go out somewhere? I could drop you in town."
An image of my friends flashed into my mind. The four of us, who used to spend our Saturdays hanging out at the shopping centre, scraping money together for chips, gossiping about the other kids at school.
"No, I'm good, thanks. I'll..."
I indicated the annex door with my head.
"Okay."
I stood by the table after they'd gone, wondering what my friends were doing at that very moment. My throat ached with self-pity. Hazel would be taking notes in a Saturday morning lecture, I suspected. The first year of medicine was pretty lecture-heavy. Joe had joined the police and I pictured her on a weekend shift, gulping down scalding coffee before dashing out to an urgent call. Patty would almost certainly still be asleep in her student apartment, unlikely to surface until mid-afternoon. They'd all have new friends by now, new in-jokes, new futures mapped out. I doubted they had time to spare a thought for me. A movement in the garden tugged me back to the present, and I stepped closer to the tall day nursery windows. Ruth was wandering out across the lawn, in her baggy grey cardigan and slippers, seemingly oblivious to the November chill. She disappeared among the trees. I was alone in the house. In the kitchen, raw onion and garlic lay abandoned on a chopping board, filling the room with their odour. I plucked two paperbacks from the bookshelf in the sitting room and took them with a cup of tea to my annex. The sound of cartoons alerted me to Edwin's return a couple of hours later. He didn't acknowledge me passing behind his sofa, his eyes fixed on the screen. I filled the kettle, but tiptoed to the doorway with it in my hand, holding my breath. Dominic's voice floated from the sitting room.
"Thinking of selling it," he was saying, "after such a short time. It's ridiculous. He knows it's a good investment, even if he doesn't want to use it himself."
I couldn't make out Ruth's reply.
"Well, something has upset him, that's for sure," Dominic said.
Ruth said something like, "his own life."
"You've picked a fight with him again, haven't you? Made him think we want him here, then told him you don't. Well, I hope you're satisfied."
I heard the creak of the sitting room door, and I dashed across the kitchen, clattering the kettle onto its base. "He should move into Winterbourne," came Ruth's voice, "with you and my mother. You'd like that, wouldn't you? You and Alex. You could suit yourselves then." I abandoned the kettle and crept back to my rooms. Dominic headed back to London on the Sunday morning. Ruth kept to herself that week, and I took Edwin out of the house as much as possible. Michael introduced me to quinces, another fruit I had never encountered. Edwin and I picked some, and I hacked them into pieces to stew with apple. But it was their fragrance that attracted me the most, an aroma that reminded me tantalizingly of Turkish delight jellies and the Earl Grey tea that Vera drank. I kept a couple on my windowsill in the annex, stroking their fuzzy yellow skins when I passed them, inhaling their beguiling scent as if it was an antidote for the tense atmosphere in the main part of the house. Dominic and Ruth argued again the following weekend, and Dominic sought me out on the Sunday afternoon.
"I'm really sorry about all this, Laura," he told me,
his lips tugged downward.
"I think Ruth could do with getting away from here for a little while. Is there any chance you'd consider looking after Edwin full-time for a few days? I might book a mini-break for her to go on with Vera."
I nodded. "Of course, whatever helps." He pressed his lips into his flat smile.
"God, I don't know what we did to deserve you. Thank you. I'll pay you at double rate for all the extra hours, overnight, all of it," he said.
I opened my mouth to protest. That would be a ridiculous amount of money for the minimal extra work it would entail. He held up a hand.
"Really, it's the only way I can justify it," he said.
Edwin whizzed down the slide and ran head-on into his father's midriff.
"It's danger money," Dominic added,
his smile reaching his eyes this time. The weekday atmosphere in the house lightened after that. Ruth told me she and Vera were going to stay at a luxury country house hotel for a few days, and she began to eat meals with us again. She asked Edwin questions about his morning activities, and sometimes she took him out with her in the afternoons so that I could study. Often she walked down to the beach with Edwin in the early evenings, saying it helped clear her head. She asked me to babysit on Saturday nights, and she and Dominic went out together, coming home late. I dozed in the day nursery until they came in, and then took myself off to the annex. But as the date of her mini-holiday approached, she withdrew again, her behaviour distracted and restless. I did my best to reassure her that Edwin would be fine with me, but she barely listened. That didn't seem to be the source of her anxiety. I knew Dominic thought she was miserable about not being pregnant again, and Vera thought she was ill with depression and ought to see a doctor. But I wasn't convinced about either of these theories. If Dominic was right about Alex putting his cottage back on the market, I guessed that Ruth was feeling guilty about pushing him away. I wondered if she missed him, and if she might attempt to entice him back to Summerbourne. I was torn between wanting to see him again and hoping I never would. I checked the clock constantly on that last morning. Dominic had taken the day off work to collect both women and chauffeur them to the hotel. I wondered if Ruth was building up to a refusal to go. However, she seemed resigned to the trip by the time Dominic arrived, and she gave Edwin a fierce hug before joining Vera on the back seat of the car. It was a grey Thursday afternoon, spitting lightly with a cold rain, and Edwin and I huddled in the doorway to wave them off. Edwin's bottom lip wobbled as the car purred away. "Is Daddy coming back after?" he asked. We gazed down the lane together. "I don't know," I said.
13. Seraphine. 140 miles of road lie between Alex Kaimal's office and Summerbourne. Questions run through my head in a relentless loop as I allow the GPS to guide me home. Why did Alex look so shocked when I told him my name? Was he telling the truth when he denied contacting Laura? Why did he say I was impossible? Who am I? The pounding at the base of my skull worsens with every mile. A dead bird lies on my front doorstep when I finally reach home. I nudge it with the tip of my shoe. Spindly pink toes and black beak point to the sky. Its eyes are half closed and sunken. I crane my neck to look for a mark on the window above. Perhaps it stunned itself against the glass and failed to recover from the impact. When I step over it, into the hall, a single black feather wafts across the tiles ahead of me, and my breath catches in my throat. I slam the door shut behind me. I could have sworn that feather was already inside the house when I opened the door. I'm losing my mind. I turn my key in the lock and stand on tiptoes to wrestle the rarely used bolt across. My neck muscles tighten more with every minute that passes, and I draw my shoulders up under my ears. When I fumble for a packet of painkillers in the kitchen cupboard, Vera's pot of sleeping pills tumbles out onto the counter. I swallow a couple of ibuprofen tablets and then stand in front of the open fridge for several minutes, concentrating on taking slow, deep breaths as the chilled air washes over my skin. The tubs of cold pasta that Edwin left for me stare sullenly out. As the interior of the fridge reaches room temperature, I kick the door shut and rummage through the pantry for a packet of crackers. A flurry of movement in the garden makes me jump. I press my forehead against the glass doors, peering at the overgrown bushes along the edge of the lawn. A band of pink still decorates the sky, but dusk is merging into night, and it's difficult to distinguish shapes from shadows. A fox, perhaps? When I turn back to the brightly lit clutter on the kitchen surfaces, my gaze falls on Vera's pill pot. The lozenges inside are tiny. Could they really be powerful enough to override the whirling thoughts in my brain? The prospect of surrendering to a night of dreamless sleep is too much to resist, and I gulp one of the pills down with a glass of water, barely feeling it as it slips down my throat. I munch through another cracker as I pace around the house, checking that all the windows and doors are locked. The drug begins to work sooner than I expected. Or perhaps it's my own exhaustion that makes my eyelids droop as I haul myself up the stairs. A numbness sloshes through my thoughts, dragging them under the surface of my consciousness. I throw myself onto my bed without undressing and slip into a deep sleep. Images of the sea fill my mind as I gradually wake in the morning. Bright sunlight bounces around my room, and an intermittent buzzing grows more familiar until I realize it's coming from my phone. It takes me a further minute to focus on the screen. A text from Pamela Larch. I thought of something else. It's not very nice, I'm afraid. If you can pop down to the office this morning, we can have a chat, Pamela. What on earth does not very nice mean, coming from Pamela? Did she type something else, something more specific, and then change it to this blandest of warnings? A nurse who deals with cancers and amputations, death and mental breakdowns. What would count as not very nice? My legs are heavy as I plod down the stairs, and I'm desperately thirsty, but I'm seized by an overwhelming need to see whether the dead bird is still on the doorstep. The stiff bolt hurts my fingers, and when I finally swing the door open, I am momentarily blinded by the sun's glare. The bird has gone. I scan the drive. Perhaps a cat took it in the night, or a fox. Something catches my eye on the narrow curve of lawn that borders the circular driveway. I take a few steps toward it, but the sharp stones under my bare feet make me wince. It looks as though marks have been burned into the scruffy grass. My heart pounds as I haul myself back upstairs to my bedroom window. The letters scorched into the lawn are angled, as if designed to be read from this exact viewpoint. Chills creep along my arms as I stare at the word they form. Stop. I stumble back down to the kitchen and try to think of innocent explanations while I pop more ibuprofen tablets through their foil seal, waiting for the kitchen tap to run cold. Village kids messing around? One of my brothers playing a joke? A rogue act by the unreliable gardening company. There must be a rational explanation. The pills make me gag. I have a sudden urge to escape from the house, to put some distance between myself and those blackened letters while I work out what to do. The doctor's office will already be open, so I'll head straight there and find out what it is that Pamela has remembered. I hold my breath as I dash out to my car, my line of sight squeezed between the damaged grass on one side and the spot where Dad's head hit the gravel on the other side. The steering wheel is clammy under my fingers, and I accelerate past the flint cottages, although no neighbours are in sight. As ever, the office is quiet. Hayley Pickersgill stares at me from behind her desk, and I ignore her, painfully aware that I'm still wearing yesterday's rumpled clothes and haven't brushed my teeth this morning, let alone my hair. My head pounds. Pamela's door is open, and when I peer in, I catch her scrolling through her phone. The staff here have too much time on their hands, I think.
Seraphine, come in. Please sit down.
Pamela's bright eyes scrutinize me, and her mouth tightens. Pamela, I attempt a smile. You said you remembered something? She repositions herself in her chair.
Well, I wasn't sure whether to mention it. Martin thinks I shouldn't.
She frowns.
But it might be relevant to what you want to know about the pregnancies and births in your family, I mean.
I nod, gripping the plastic arms of my chair, watching her.
It's something people used to talk about when I was little, she says. In the village. In the playground at school. Your mum was a few years older than us. In the top class, I think, when Martin and I were in the infants. But we knew all about her. You know what the village is like.
I nod again.
Well, she says, she had a twin. Your mother, I mean. She had a twin brother.
Oh, right. I say, yes, the brother mentioned in my mother's obituary. Do you know what happened to him?
Well, he died, you see.
She's twisting a pen over and over in her hands, and she looks down at this now rather than at me. Before he was born, your grandmother was pregnant with twins, but only Ruth survived. Oh, I stare at her. That's so sad. Gran never said. I don't remember his name, she says. I'm sorry. I shake my head. Well, it was before you were born. It must have been terrible for Gran. I think about Vera, and the way she always makes a point of referring to Danny and me as the Summerborn twins. I feel guilty to remember how it sometimes irritated me. Now that I know she lost her own twin baby, as well as her grandson Theo. But, I say, why did Martin think you shouldn't tell me? Pamela fiddles with her pen again.
Well, not that bit. It was what the other kids used to say, you see. They used to say mean things to her about it. Nasty things.
She swallows. They said that Ruth strangled him. My mouth falls open.
What? He was born dead, you see, with the cord around his neck. They said she wrapped it round his neck while they were still inside the womb together. Twice around his neck, they said. And then she choked him to death. On purpose.
I stare at her. But that's ridiculous.
Horrific. How could they say that?
I know, she says.
And of course it's not true.
Well, of course not.
But I think that's what reminded people of the other stories, the old stories.
Her fingers are still now. She waits, and I sense she's giving me a chance to walk away, to say I don't want to hear. What old stories? I ask. That twins never survive at Summerborn, Pamela says. She meets my eyes then, and her expression is apologetic, almost fearful. I try to keep my voice calm, but my pulse is jumping.
That's... what do you mean?
The original Summerborn, the man who built the house, she says. He got into financial difficulties, apparently, nearly went bankrupt. He had baby twins, and they say he cheated people in the village. Claimed he'd paid them for goods and services when he hadn't, that sort of thing. I watch her. This was a very long time ago.
I know, she says. So the story goes that it was a local stonemason that built the folly for him, did all those carvings and everything, and the village blacksmith made the cannon for the sundial. And when it was all finished, Mr. Summerborn, he said a certain price had been agreed, and the stonemason and blacksmith said it was double that. And they argued, you can imagine, and the villagers threatened to knock the whole thing down. But when they went up there, all angry, Mr. Summerborn had parked his baby twins inside the circular wall, right up against the tower, in their baby carriage, fast asleep.
I'm transfixed despite myself. Go on. Pamela blows out a puff of air.
Well, the villagers turned back. They were decent people. They didn't want a scene with the babies crying and everyone shouting and all that. So they cut their losses and went home. But that night,
she frowns at me.
That night,
one of them babies disappeared from its cot in the nursery at Summerborn.
Vanished. Just like that.
I swallow. What happened?
They never found a trace. No sign of a break-in. Everyone had an alibi. People said the fairies had taken him as a punishment.
A laugh escapes me.
Right. Okay. Fairies obviously much more likely than a human being with a grudge.
Pamela's look is almost disapproving.
I'm just telling you what they say. That from that day on, the Summerborn family hasn't been allowed to keep its twins. Your mother's twin brother died in the womb. Your older brother, Theo, fell over the cliff. And you and Danny.
I stare at her.
Me and Danny what?
Well, some people say your poor mother bargained with her life to try to keep both of you safe. I shove my chair backwards, scrambling to move away from her. How can you say that? And some people say. She stretches a hand toward me. I'm sorry, Seraphine, but you wanted to know. My heart is pounding. I stumble backward until the door handle jabs into the small of my back. What? Some people say it didn't work. That someone took your mother's real babies anyway. That you and Danny aren't real summer-born twins at all. She tilts her head, her expression sympathetic. I'm sorry, Seraphine, and I'm sure it can't be true, but I feel you ought to know that that's what people say. I fumble for the door handle and finally wrench it open. Haley straightens in her seat as I lurch into the waiting room, her mouth falling open. Out in the high street, the sun is high and fierce, and everything around me shimmers with heat. Houses and cars and lampposts look strangely distorted. I'm not certain whether I've actually woken up this morning or whether I'm trapped in a nightmare.
14. Laura, November 1991. Dominic did return to Summerbourne after dropping Ruth and Vera at their hotel. It was already dark, and he brought the crisp chill of the November night into the hall with him.
Guess where we're going tomorrow,
he said to Edwin.
I'll give you a clue. Lots of water and lots of fishes.
The sea, Edwin shouted.
The aquarium, Dominic said.
He gave me a quick grin.
Didn't fancy going back to work just for one day.
When I came down from putting Edwin to bed, Dominic called me into the sitting room. The curtains were open, and he was gazing out at the sky, his back to me.
It's a blue moon tonight, he said. Come and look.
I stood alongside him. Warm air rose from the radiator and mingled with the cold breath of the glass. It doesn't look blue, he chuckled.
It's an old farmer's term. When a season has four full moons instead of three, it doesn't happen very often. The third one is called a blue moon.
Oh, I didn't know it was an actual thing. I thought about it. Why isn't it the last one that's called the blue moon? The fourth one is the extra one, surely. He gave me a sideways glance.
I've no idea. I never thought about it like that.
I leaned closer to the window to peer at it, my breath misting the glass. I'm shocked, I said, that it's not actually blue.
Wait till you see a black moon.
He turned to me, his hip against the windowsill.
Next summer, I'll find the date for you. You'll be quite overwhelmed.
Oh, he smiled.
Some people say a blue moon is just a second full moon in a calendar month, much more common.
I sucked in my breath. How dare they? A bark of laughter escaped him, and he swiveled farther round to lean back against the radiator. The surprise in his eyes blinked into a more focused gleam.
There's more to you than you let on, isn't there?
He said. I don't know what you mean.
You never talk about yourself. You're home.
I shrugged. I don't think about it much.
To a lot of people, it's the most important thing about them. Where they come from, who their family is.
Not to me, I said.
You lived with your mum before this?
I nodded. And Beaky, her partner. He doesn't like me. Dominic's eyebrows shot up.
Beaky?
Yep. He studied my face.
Was it that bad?
I walked away, pausing at the coffee table with my back to him. An opened bottle of red wine waited on it, two glasses by its side. Dominic's sleeve brushed against mine on his way to the sofa.
Join me?
He picked up the bottle and tilted a glass toward me questioningly. I hesitated. The sitting room door was ajar,
the curtains open. I rubbed my arms.
I'll light the fire, he said. We should celebrate the blue moon. Here, sit.
I pulled the curtains closed before sinking onto the sofa. The wine was warm, and I swirled it around my mouth, trying to get used to the bitter furriness of it, as I watched Dominic crouch over the hearth with a box of matches. He coaxed a pile of kindling into flames, then arranged logs over the top. A billow of smoke puffed into the room, carrying an aroma of something musty and old.
So, what do you want to do with your life, then?
He asked as he sank down next to me with his own full glass.
After you finish here, after your biochemistry degree or whatever.
I curled up in my half of the sofa and sighed. I don't know. Travel, maybe.
With your friends?
I shrugged. I don't know. We used to talk about it. They've probably made new plans by now.
You're very good with Edwin. I can see you settling down and having a family of your own one day.
The heavy flavour of the wine had grown on me, and I drained my glass. Yeah.
But meanwhile, the world is your oyster.
I'd walk away from everything if I could, I said. Start again. Be someone new.
Reinvent yourself.
I looked directly at him then. His expression was open, no glint of judgment in his eyes. I held his gaze for a moment, and then nodded. Yeah, that'd be nice. He considered this and didn't press me further. The combination of wine and warmth and companionable silence helped my muscles relax, and I shifted into a more comfortable position. He refilled my glass, and we sat and watched the flames dance over the puckering logs.
Funny thing, life,
he said eventually. His voice was low and scratchy.
One minute you've got everything you ever wanted, and the next minute...
His pupils were dilated in the low light, reflecting the flickering yellow of the fire. Theo, I said. He tipped his head back, staring at the ceiling.
Did Ruth tell you how it happened?
Alex told me.
I think about it all the time. I think about him all the time.
I leaned toward him and placed my hand over his. His hands were broader than Alex's, and not as smooth. His knuckles bore smudges of soot from the fire, and it made him seem vulnerable somehow. I'm sorry, I said. He rolled his head forward, tucking his chin down and studying my hand. He turned it over, running his thumb over my palm. A tingle spread through my body, and I savored the sensation.
You know, it's funny, he said. I thought that day we all went to the beach, when you went on the topper with Alex. I thought maybe you two might.
I shook my head, tried to smile. Nope.
Ah.
He stroked my palm again, and then looked at me.
You wanted to?
When I didn't answer straight away, he turned his attention back to my hand. I closed my eyes to concentrate on the feeling of his thumb running along the underside of my fingers, crossing my palm, stroking circles on the inside of my wrist. I felt as though I was floating, as if my muscles had melted. Someone like him would never be interested in someone like me, I said, without opening my eyes. I was picturing the way Alex watched Ruth's movements from under half-lowered lids, his concentration intense. I was picturing the way he'd stood on the doorstep in the rain, his clothes dripping, craning his neck for a glimpse of her. The stroking stopped, and I opened my eyes to find Dominic brushing a strand of hair from my cheek.
Then someone like him is a fool, he said.
I watched his lips as he leaned toward me. His fingers traced through my hair to the back of my head. We paused with our faces an inch apart.
"We shouldn't," he said, "but you're just so..."
His lips brushed against mine, and he drew back, and the sudden movement drew a cold draught between us, where the warmth of his chest had just been. I put one hand behind his head and pulled him back down toward me. It had been a long time since I'd done this. I thought of Alex as we kissed at first. We could have... But this wasn't Alex. This was someone who wanted me, who really wanted me right now. The deeper I kissed him, the deeper he kissed me, and the faster I tugged at his clothes, the faster he tugged at mine. And I didn't mind that he wasn't Alex anymore. I was only aware of the flames and the shadows and his unfamiliar body against mine. I focused on the moment with no thoughts of the barriers that ought to separate us and no consideration of the consequences. We wanted each other. We needed each other. "Don't go," I said, as he rolled off me afterward. He kept his back to me, putting a distance between us, even while our bodies were still cooling. The fire had dwindled to flakes of ash. He dragged the curtains apart with a harsh clatter of metal hoops and rubbed at the condensation on the glass. His hair took on a silvery tint in the moonlight. "When is the next blue moon?" I asked from the sofa. He shook his head. His shoulders were hunched. I wrapped my arms tighter around my knees. A scuffling sound in the hall made us both jump,